Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. It's November 20th, 2012. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. We're sponsored by GreatBrewers.com. They'll bring the online connection to the world of craft beer to you. And also thanks to the Good Beer Seal, GoodBeerSeal.com. I've got two great guests on tonight. Our good friend Garrett Oliver, brewmaster from Brooklyn Brewery. And Ken Landon, the owner of Crossroads Brewing Company, a new small brew pub up in Athens, New York. And we'll also be talking to Dave Miller, author of Brew Like a Pro, on the second segment tonight. Well, welcome, gentlemen. Welcome to the show.
Cheers.
Cheers. Good to see you. Good to
be here. Garrett, it's been a little while. What's been going on the last couple of months with you?
We've been having a bit of fun. We hired four new brewers in the last 6 weeks or so, put in eight 200-barrel tanks. And I just got back from Brazil, where we did our latest collaboration.
Wow, with a certain brewery?
With a certain brewery called Vals. I've known those guys for a long time, been going down to Brazil a lot for the last 6 or 7 years. And, we started selling some beer down there. So I had this idea that actually came to me when we were at St. Somewhere, a great little brewery down in Florida, and I saw this sugarcane around, and I said, boy, wouldn't it be cool if we could make a beer from sugarcane? And when the guys from Vault said that they wanted to do something together, I knew exactly what I wanted to do. And, we really put it together. I give a lot of kudos to those guys, because it wasn't that easy to put this idea in motion. But we cut 700 pounds worth of, actually 700 kilos worth of sugarcane, and we trucked it back to the brewery, and then we had a crusher there at the brewery, and we crushed the sugarcane directly into the kettle. And it made up about 15% of the sugars in this beer called Saison de Caipira. And Caipira kind of, it means country bumpkin kind of guy. So it's a farmhouse ale with 15% straight cane juice.
Wow. And are you going to be selling that here in New York too?
We'll probably get some in just to bring to events. But, by and large, it's going to be down there. Vals is a small brewery. They don't sell in the United States. But they're good pals. And, what was cool about it is that it's a collaboration that I couldn't really do here. We don't have sugarcane. So I learned a lot about sugarcane. And it's you ever talk about unskilled labor, like, cutting things with a machete, it's actually a lot harder than it looks.
So you find it interesting to work with traditional ingredients, regional ingredients, and new ways with beer, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think, we were the first brewery anywhere to do collaborations, back in 1997. Well before it became a fad, I shouldn't say a fad, a tradition, a new tradition of American brewing, which is great. But these days, I always want to do stuff that's not just, this brewery and that brewery are together. We only do stuff with people that we know, that we already hang out with, that are already our friends. And we want to do something that, is new and bring some new ideas to things. So, I'm sure someone's done this before, but I never heard of it. So it's new to us.
Well, I hope we can try that beer when it's ready.
Yeah, absolutely.
So your strategy at Brooklyn Brewery, I know you guys are doing some export. I know that you've been selling in Sweden.
Yep.
And I follow your blog, and I know that you've got this thing, the food experiment guys, Nick and Theo, and they seem to go where you guys have your beer. So what's the Sweden connection?
Well, the whole thing is evolving, but the Sweden connection is a long story. But basically, I won an award in 2003 called the Sempa Ardens Pris, for beer culture in Denmark, and that kind of started us rolling in Scandinavia. So believe it or not, the funny little thing about Brooklyn Brewery is, despite the fact that we're still a relatively small brewery, many of the other craft breweries think of our many times our size, but the number two market for Brooklyn Brewery outside of New York City itself is Sweden.
Wow, that's amazing.
We sell a full 20% of our beer overseas. But, we were always traveling people, and that's kind of where Brooklyn Brewery comes from. Steve Hindy, me, it comes out of being overseas. So the idea that we would ever stay home would be ridiculous in the first place. We never stayed home. We were overseas by 1990.
And then, you know, with some of your newer beers like the Brewmaster's Reserve Series, is that really geared towards New York, or are you also exporting those as well?
We don't export those, at least not yet. We'll send them to festivals and over for events. You know, we'll do tap takeovers in places like Stockholm and have, you know, 15 or 20 taps up. But these days, that's becoming something that a lot of people, you know, do. I mean, you know, Mickler can probably put up more beers, you know, you know, at Jimmy's today than I can. You know, it's, you know, 30 or 40 different beers. So, you know, it's just a fun thing to do. But, you know, we're in 17 countries, you know, and we're getting particularly every one of our brewing team is going to be doing an overseas project this year. So we got a lot of stuff going on. It's, you know, it's in high gear just the same way as it is for everybody.
Well, you've also been making some new specialty beers, like the Brooklyn Defender. That was a really great beer. I mean, we got two kegs, and that just flew out. And it was like when I realized how good it was, it was gone. Yeah. And now you've got this There Will Be Black, the Black IPA.
Yeah. Well, actually, specifically, we didn't call it a Black IPA. You'll notice if you – in fact, you know, we talked about in our in my write-up for – I talked about how it's not Black IPA because black is not pale. And you know, the whole idea of the name "There Will Be Black" comes partly out of making fun of the idea of black IPA, which to me is ridiculous. And actually, I was really gratified to see, judging the Great American Beer Festival this year, that Black IPA, which was there last year, has now gone away, and it's called American Black Ale because too many people had objected.
Well, one thing I like about the black American Black Ale, aka Black IPA, I kind of like where it's going because I've seen also a lot of like red ales that have the high IBUs. Like Maine has their Zoe, and there's a couple others. Carton locally has this red rye. It's like rye hoppiness, and no one's calling them IPAs.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's just you know, it gets boring after a while, you know, to argue about it. I actually have a lot of fun arguing about it, but. You know, I think nomenclature is important, and if you're going to call everything that's hoppy is now some kind of IPA, then eventually IPA doesn't mean anything at all. You know, so if you cross a horse with a dog, you know, you don't get, it's like, well, what do you get? Well, it's not a kind of dog. It's something else. You know, it's a horse dog. It's a dog horse, you know.
Well, the worst example is white IPA. I was lucky to sit in with an Ale Street News tasting panel the other day, and the surprise was, with Paul Sullivan, the surprise was, oh, it's white IPA. And the consensus was that's not really a style yet.
Well, you know, I guess it's, you know, you decide when the horse is out of the barn. You know, there's a very wide range of opinion out there. Some people think, you know, anything goes. And I think anything goes for beer. But names, well, you know, language is power. And it's one thing the French will definitely tell you about is one of the reasons why, and you as a chef know this, one reason why French food is so powerful in the world is not because they invented most of that stuff. Most of their food was invented by the Italians, you know, but, you know, this sort of haute cuisine. But the fact that when you say hollandaise sauce, it means only one thing. You know, hollandaise sauce is hollandaise sauce. You can walk into a place in Cambodia and say to a chef, make me hollandaise sauce. And there's no question as to what it means. You know, and champagne is champagne. And that gives cultural force. You know, and you can tell your stories. You can transmit your information. We have such great stories to tell. We don't need to, you know, make up new names that other people will be talking about in 200 years. They'll say, I brewed a whatever, and you will have made it up, you know, in 2013. That's awesome. I mean, when we made Weiss beer with Hans-Peter Drexler, we didn't call it Weiss IPA. I made up a word, Hopfenweiss. Well, people should make stuff up. You're going to be creative.
Go all the way. Yeah. That's one of my favorite beers.
Yeah. Well, you know, funny thing is people think that it's an actual beer style now. Yep, maybe it should be.
Well, you're right about styles. And we can hear it, too. Like, you know, with the small American breweries. Well, first, let's dive into the small American brewery thing. You know, the other day someone asked me, you know, what's the definition of a nano brewery? And I had to step back and I said, you know, first of all, no one even knows what craft breweries are because the term is so broad. But I said, for the average person, I still think they relate to this name microbrewery. You know, so but you've got Kenny Crossroads up in Athens, New York. You're like making what, 600 barrels a year or something?
Yeah, we're probably on track this year to do about 800 barrels.
So you're like a brew pub microbrewery. And when you're talking about these styles, like our friends at Carton in New Jersey, they're only making beers with their own name. So it's the opposite of codifying you know, a set style. They're saying they have a beer that I call a hoppy Kolsch. They call it their boat beer, and they say it's a session ale because they're afraid. First, they're afraid of being judged by, you know, the people on the beer judge certification program. They don't want to be compared to a traditional style like Kolsch, the same way you're saying Hollandaise or Champagne have, you know, standards. But with you guys being real small breweries making new beers, I mean, do you feel like you have to label it something an IPA, or do you feel like you're taking creative license and making up your own names?
You know, that's tough. We definitely want to stay along the lines. We want to have fun with the actual names of the beers, but as far as sticking with the traditional styles, you know, it is what it is. We're going to call an IPA an IPA. We're going to call a saison, and so forth. So, but.
You're trying to stick with traditional styles, pretty much.
I mean, Hutch, our brewer, he's, you know, he's given full rein to really experiment and do whatever he wants. So he has a tendency to, especially this time of year, he's brewing some stronger ales and some, some Belgians, stronger Belgians. So it's interesting. It's fun. And again, with the name, we try and have fun with the names of our beers as well.
So what are some of the beers you brought for us tonight, Ken? Like the names and what style they are?
Well, actually, our signature beer is Outrage IPA. And kind of how that name came about is basically at the end of the day, if you're not outraged, you're not paying attention. So that's how we got Outrage. Our seasonal is a coffee porter, and we call that Fat Boy Porter. So we just, you know, we're just having fun with the names. Sticking with the, you know, the styles, traditional styles. Again,
you're making good beer. Like last year you won at New York Tap. You won Best Hudson Valley Brewery.
Yeah.
You guys are still small. You know, you got a 7-barrel system. So
yeah.
Welcome to the show. I'm glad you're on it. And with Garrett here, I hope you guys can have a little dialogue because I want Garrett to weigh in on, you know, you've been doing this a while. You started as a home brewer. And, you know, what advice do you have for these small brew pubs and, you know, these new microbreweries that are out there just setting up with small systems? You know, how do you see it from when you guys started to where you are now? You know, any advice for them?
Well, I don't think I have advice. They're obviously doing great. I don't think they need any advice from me. Well, what's interesting is to watch the whole thing develop and people go through some of the same stuff that we did, you know, whether you're considering it like, you know, a good thing or not. You know, we self-distributed for a long time, and then it ended up with 200 different brands that we were selling, and because in 1990, nobody would put an amber beer on a truck and sell it to anybody. And then Sierra Nevada came to us and said, nobody will take our beer either. Will you take it? And we're like, okay, we'll put your beer on our truck. And then Chimay came and said, nobody wants our beer. Can you put it on our truck? And we wanted to fill our trucks up so that at least when the truck showed up, we would drop off 10 cases instead of two. And not lose money every time we stopped the truck. And that was really what it was about. And we ended up with a distribution company that we later ended up upselling. But for a long time, you know, that was a big part of our business was, you know, distributing not just our beer, but, you know, almost all of our competitors.
And Kenny, you're also doing that too, like self-distributing, right?
Yeah, I self-distribute up in the Hudson Valley, Albany. We come down as far as Newburgh, but we want self-distribution to us, especially as we're in our growing phase. I want to hear about any of the problems immediately. I don't want it to get lost in the shuffle. If there is an issue with one of our products out there, I want it to come directly to me. I want to handle the problem immediately and figure out what went wrong and make sure that everyone's happy in the long run. So.
And then you also distribute in New York, right?
Yes, we do. We work with American Beer. We send about 32 kegs a month down to these guys, and they do a great job putting it out into the marketplace in Brooklyn and Manhattan. And we're very happy.
That's great. All right, guys, thanks for coming on. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
You're listening to Cheaters by Pamela Royal on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Mm-hmm. Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're out here at Roberta's in Bushwick. We're going to have a pizza with some beer tonight, and we've got Ken from Crossroads and Garrett Oliver from Brooklyn Brewery. Garrett, what were you saying about IPAs and this black IPA thing?
Well, I mean, we were just talking about it during during the break. I mean, if you read Mitch Steele's new book, you know, I mean, I know that he has a different perspective on it because there is a black beer on the cover of his book IPA. So, you know, he kind of veers off into that, and you can ask him his own opinion. But, you know, IPA was never black. And, of course, the pale, the P in IPA stands for pale, and IPAs were quite pale. So, you know, what if you're going to put the name IPA on every hoppy beer you ever make, then how many kinds of IPA are there going to be? And IPA will just mean hoppy? Mm-hmm. Is that what it means? Hoppy and slightly strong, no matter what? Unless it has a Belgian yeast, and maybe then it's Belgian double imperial IPA. You know, I think if you look even at our beers, Brooklyn Lager is by far our number one selling beer. You find it all over the place. I mean, you know, what style is Brooklyn Lager? Brooklyn Lager is Brooklyn Lager style. Local One is Local One. It doesn't say Local One Saison or Local One Triple or Local One Belgian Strong Golden. It's like, I know it's easier to sell things, but, you know, and, you know, it's easy to communicate. And when people come to you during a beer festival, that's when it gets really hard, you know, because you know the way it is. You're standing there at the bar, you know, hi, what would you like? And it's like, what is it? And you got to get it out really fast. But I'm not going to go there. I'm not calling an American wheat beer Hefeweizen, you know, because people like the word Hefeweizen. Hefeweizen is Hefeweizen, you know, and it has a certain set of flavors and it means something. You know, I mean, I have, you know, a flavor and aroma in my head when you say Hefeweizen, and I want it to stay there. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to personally ruin that by calling it, you know, Hefeweizen IPA. So Hopfenweizen, you know, which you can say, well, what does that mean? And then I can explain it to you.
Well, it is a catchy name. Hey, we're going to take one step back. We've got a call-in guest, Dave Miller, who is a former brewer at Blackstone Brewery in Nashville, started as a home brewer, has a new book out called Brew Like a Pro. And Dave, thanks for calling in today. How are you?
Doing fine, thank you.
You know, I was thinking about a couple of things. First, you know, Garrett's a great author. One of my favorite beer books ever is the Good Beer book that Garrett wrote in 1997 with Timothy Harper. I don't know if any of you even remember that book, but it was a book that I read in the 90s and then I found again 10 years later and reread. And so he's sitting here with us tonight, and Ken, the owner of Crossroads Brewing, a small brew pub up in Athens, New York. So your background's really interesting. I know that you started as a home brewer, and you were an award-winning home brewer, and you disparage your achievements. You said in 1981, you know, you were just getting started, and you went on to be the professional brewer at Blackstone in Nashville. Your book's really interesting. Tell us why you wrote this book, Brew Like a Pro.
Well, I wrote the book because I retired from pub brewing in 2008, and after a suitable period to recover from, you know, just having to brew every day so that, you know, it wasn't really fun anymore. You know, it was my profession. I was proud of it. I was happy to do it, but it wasn't a hobby anymore. After I'd been out of brewing for about a year, I got the itch to homebrew again, and I started doing it. And that led to the book because I found myself approaching the problems of making beer at home in the light of my experience as a professional brewer. And I hope to contribute some insight from, you know, that side of the brewing world to other home brewers who are, you know, faced with choices about how to make beer.
So let's go way back. So I'm from your book. You said that when you first started out as a home brewer, one of the epiphanies you had was you realized you wanted to make all grain brewing.
Oh yeah.
And tell us why that's important, and you know what people can learn from you in that regard.
Well, let's just look. Beer is made from grain. That's what defines beer, is that it's made from grain, specifically from mainly malted barley, maybe malted wheat or a few other things, but that's what makes beer beer. If you could call something made from malt extract or some other product beer, but you won't get the same flavor out of it. You know, making an extract out of malted barley changes it, and you just simply don't get the same flavor profiles. And that's what I found impossible, you know, almost right from the beginning. I was trying to make beer that tasted like the beer I was, you know, buying in the stores, and I couldn't do it. And that's what led me to decide that, you know, I was go whole hog, try to make beer from grain, or just give up altogether.
And then since then, you said homebrewing's come a long way since 1981. You've actually been a professional brewer. So what were you missing when you got out of working in a brew pub? What was missing for you as a home brewer?
What was missing for me? I just found that I still enjoyed working with the ingredients and, engaging in the process of making beer. It's an outlet for your creativity. And frankly, you know, with all the many wonderful things about brewing professionally, there's less chance to indulge your creativity when you're a professional than there is when you're home brewing, and you don't have to answer to anything except your own taste as far as what you do.
All right, Garrett, do you want to ask any questions?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, I'm looking through the book, and I just want to point out to everybody this book. I don't know whose copy this is. It must have about 100 post-it notes stuck to the edge of it. So someone's been reading this very closely, you know, which is always a cool thing
That's,
to see.
You're on the right team. Brie O'Connor, our producer, the Beer Sessions Radio team, has gone through this book.
Yeah, no, I've never seen a book
and
as
we approve
flat.
Of it. Dave, we really like your book, Brew Like a Pro. We're just trying to just get into your head, man.
I'm gratified. There's, you know, I love to autograph my books for people, but when somebody brings me an old dog-eared copy that, you know, is all chewed up,
that's the best.
I know they've really thumbed through it. Those are the books I like to autograph the very most.
Yeah, somebody brought me one copy of the Brewmaster's Table once, and it was broken in half. The cover was gone. The spine was broken. It was in two pieces, and it was in a Ziploc bag. You know, and I decided, I was like, this is the most awesome book I've ever seen. I definitely know what you mean. No, I mean, when I look at the overall thing here, and this is not a criticism, it's just a thought. It's like, I say, okay, it says brew like a pro. It's like, well, in one way, I think you can't brew like a pro, don't want to brew like a pro, and that the main difference between a hobby, and it's kind of what you said, a hobby and a job, is that, you know, a hobby is just for fun, and you should let it, you know, let it run that way. I think that the home brewer has certain advantages, and the professional brewer has certain advantages. And I understand what you're saying. You're showing people the stuff that you learned and how you can apply it. I think that, you know, I know that as a home cook, and I do cook in front of audiences too, there's a real difference between cooking for people at home and cooking for people in a restaurant. And if you, I'm a pretty damn good cook, but if you put me in a restaurant kitchen on Saturday night, I'm like less than useless. And home, home brewing. I tell home brewers, and I think it's true. Home brewing actually bears no resemblance to brewing in a brewery. The same way that cooking at home bears no resemblance to working in a restaurant kitchen. There are no tickets coming in. You're not under that kind of pressure. It's a whole different thing. But I understand the direction that you're talking about, which is, you know, here's an opportunity to learn what I learned in many years of professional brewing and how you can take your home brewing to a different level.
Well, I agree with you, Garrett, that, all that pressure is missing, and that's one of the things that's wonderful about home brewing. And, yes, it takes a different set of skills and really, in a lot of ways, a different mindset to do something for a living. Having worked in brew pubs for a long time, I know what you mean. I'm also somebody who does a lot of cooking at home, and I can't imagine anything that would be less like what I do at home than you know, trying to cook in a restaurant kitchen on a Friday night. But the process is the same. What it shares, you know, what cooking shares, however you do it, is that there's a process that you go through. And the better you understand that process, the better you're able to control that process, the better the results you're going to get. And a professional has to learn how that, has to learn how to control his process and manage it the best he can to get the best possible result, because he's a pro. But I think homebrewers could benefit from taking a professional approach, if you want to call it that, if you understand it in that light, in the light of
so, Dave,
mastering the process
in your book,
and being able to therefore know what you're going to get out at the end when you commence.
Well, I think these days homebrewers are just so fantastically. I mean, many of them are in many ways every bit as sophisticated or more sophisticated than many professional brewers that I know about their understanding of process, you know, et cetera, which I think really separates homebrewing today from homebrewing when I was doing it, maybe when you were doing it. You know, we were making beer because it was the only way to get any. And, you know, I mean, we knew a lot and we thought we were pretty good, but you got guys at home with whole, they got PLCs, they got, I mean, temperature controls, like I can change the temperature of my fermenter from my phone, and you're like, and there are times I kind of feel like, dude, you've taken all the fun out of it.
Well, I know what you mean about that, and, you're right to a degree, but I hope that I'm able to contribute still in the book a few insights from somebody who's done it, you know, because I look at the home brewing scene today, and yes, I see a lot of sophistication, but I still think you know, there's still something that I think I can contribute in my insight from my years of brewing professionally to help.
Hey, Dave, let me interrupt.
Wait, let me just say, I'm sure that's true. I mean, I want to read this book. I'm not. That's not a criticism. I'm just saying that I'm fascinated by the differences in the culture there, and I really want to read like how you've parsed this whole thing, because I've never read a book like this.
Yeah. Well, the way I parse it is. You know, I take what I describe early on in the book. I take a minimalist approach. I'm looking at how to do this, how to master this process, hopefully without having to break your budget. You know, you mentioned things like, you know, brewers with PLC controls and so forth, and you know, basically in some ways, some of those home breweries are more sophisticated than a lot of pub breweries are. Right, you know, your average pub brewery, you can't do anything about the temperature. You just better mix the mash. You just better get your mash mixed right, because once you do it, there's nothing you can do to change the temperature. You know what I mean,
Dave? Let me just step. Dave, bring it back. I just want to cover a little bit more of your book. I know that the subtitle is "Brew Like a Pro, Make Pub Style Draft Beer at Home." What is that key part to you? So making the pub style draft beer at home. What does a home brewer need to do that you know that they don't?
What does a home brewer need to do? Well, the first thing he needs to do is forget about bottles. One of the first things I tell the readers is, you want to make beer at home. Take this approach. Look at what will really help you. Look at what you're in this for. You're in this to make good beer. You don't need to be spending hours and hours and hours delabeling bottles, cleaning bottles, doing all of that work. Build yourself a draft system right from the start, and you'll spend your time making beer instead of being a low-level cleaning slave.
Well, how will you ever achieve Zen enlightenment?
Of, you know, the approach I took to it.
Dave, listen, you know, your book's coming out by Story Publishing. They have a lot of really good books about beer. Joe and Dennis Fisher, Homebrewer's Garden, one of my favorite books. When is your book coming out?
It comes out on November the 28th.
So next week. That's awesome.
That's right.
Dave, we're gonna take a short break. Would you stay on the line with us? And when
sure.
we come back, we'll talk more about some local brew pubs and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we'll be back in a few minutes on Beer Sessions Radio.
This one's called She Was Only Two by Pamela Royal on Beer Sessions Radio.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're here at Roberta's in Bushwick. I'm Jimmy Carboni from Jimmy's Number 43 and the Good Beer Seal. We've got a great show tonight. We're talking about beer books and how to brew like a pro with Dave Miller and Garrett Oliver and Ken from Crossroads up in Athens, New York. And we're joined by Brandon Moore, a rep, New York City beer rep at American Beer Distributors, one of the oldest family-owned distributorships in New York. All right, Dave, you're still on the air, right?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. So we're going to talk about some other things. We're going to talk about brew pubs and actually... So first, tell us how you got started. You started as a home brewer, and then you ended up at Blackstone in Nashville. How did you go from being a home brewer to being a pro?
Well, I pretty much had to kind of... What happened was I started home brewing. I pretty quickly got the idea that I wanted to start making beer from grain. And when I had done some of that, I just went at a certain point. I don't know exactly where the tipping point was, but sometime in the early 1980s, I started reading stories about how out in California and in Washington, people were coming up with this new concept of brew pubs. And I thought, geez, I want to do this. In other words, I went nuts. I decided I wanted to do this for a living, and then we had formed a home brewing club in St. Louis, where I was then living in the mid 1980s. My friend John Sterling, who has a little nice piece about my book on the back of the cover, if you noticed, who was actually the founder of the St. Louis Brews. And I formed a little, I guess you'd call it a political action committee, with the intention of getting brew pubs legalized in the state of Missouri. And I did this with the idea that hopefully, if we would get them legalized, that maybe I could hook up with some entrepreneurial type who was interested in owning a brew pub and, you know, might be willing to hire me. And I'm the luckiest guy in the world because it all worked out exactly the way I had hoped. In the course of getting the law passed, I met Tom Schlafly and Dan Kopman, who are the principals of Schlafly Beer, as you know. And they hired me as their first brewmaster when we got the bill passed, and I started working for them.
Well, that's terrific. One quick thing, Dave. So one thing you mentioned. You're talking about scaling up recipes, and this is where Garrett can weigh in. You know, as a home brewer, you might make a typical, 5-gallon batch, and then you go into a brew pub, you're making a 15-barrel. How do you scale up your recipes, you know, to go from home brewing to – because that's a big issue. There's also the nano breweries now, people making these real – I know guys are making half-barrel batches, 1-barrel batches, and they even go up to 5-barrel batches. It takes them a long time to adjust. What is the scalability with beer? Why can't you just, like – quadruple or 10 times the recipe?
Yeah, well, we found, you know, I found out pretty quick when I started working for Tom Schlafly that you can't do that. It doesn't work out too well. You can't just take a 5-gallon recipe and multiply it by 100 and get a 15-barrel recipe. Other than that, I just say, you know, you can start with that. If you have some experience, you might have an idea what kind of adjustments you need to make. You'll probably, you know, get less color, for instance, out of your special malts. You might have to adjust that. But But it's really just a matter. And on the other hand, you're going to get a lot more hop utilization probably out of a bigger kettle than you will out of your 5-gallon homebrew kettle.
But so, Garrett, what is it about?
I don't really know any rules for this.
Well, let's Garrett, your feedback. I mean, you started as a home brewer, and you guys had a small brewery, and now you've scaled up. I mean, what is the scalability in beer? You think that you could just, like I said, times 100 or times 10 and make the same beer, but it's not the case.
I'm afraid.
Yeah, not the case at all, and it's a good example of the sort of thing, you know, kind of like restaurant versus your home kitchen, you know, stuff that doesn't work. And I've learned that the hard way doing over at Brooklyn Kitchen. We do dinners, and we cook for 25 people at a time, and you kind of learn the stuff that you can do for a few people at home. And when you got to do 25 of them, you know, for example, omelets, try to turn out 25 omelets for people at once. doesn't work.
Certain things, you know, you wonder why you seldom find certain kinds of dishes featured at a restaurant, and then you think about what it's like to actually prepare them.
It's like, oh, wait a minute, I don't have 2 quarts of melted butter. No, I mean, the secret of restaurant cooking. But, I mean, I find that proportions are scalable, proportions of malts. For example, if you have a recipe that's, say, you know, 70% pale malt and 10%, that's largely scalable. As Dave was saying, hop utilization, bitterness is not scalable at all. That's the thing that is most likely to be off. And it really depends on what else you're doing. Dry hopping turns out differently. Everything turns out differently.
So we don't do it.
I do not do test brews. So when we brew at the brewery, we brew, you know, 25 or 50 barrels first shot. When we brew up at Matt's, we brew 500 barrels on the first shot. I'm not going to go and make 5 gallons of something that I'm going to brew 500 barrels of. You know, I mean, I've been doing this for 20-something years. If I don't know what's going to happen by now, I probably should quit. So that's why I'm here.
I'd agree with you, Garrett, on that one. It's really hard. Now, it is true that all the major the big industrial breweries do have pilot breweries, and they do use them. And you know, from what everybody tells me, who works there, you know, that the 15 they've got about a, it's approximately a 15 barrel pilot brewery at the Anheuser-Busch plant in St. Louis, and they can make Budweiser.
Well, 15 barrels to 500, it turns out, is not nearly the same as 5 gallons to 15 barrels. You know,
The next thing I was going to say is that, you know, it's when you're talking about really, really small quantities like 5 or 10 gallons that you have trouble scaling up, I think.
But I find that, you know, most people have trouble. Like, we got a new brewery. We have 2 kettles, one's 25 and one's 50. Sometimes we use them both in the same day. And even scaling up some of our things like brewing IPA on the new system, you know, we had different levels, different kind of bitterness. You know, our crush was different. You know, trying to work those things through and get the flavor profiles. You know, it does take some time.
Yeah.
And there are
Well, your new 50, that's a Rolec Brewhouse, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I know about this because we, you know, Blackstone's new shipping brewery is a Rolec, and the kettle arrangement is quite different, so I'm not surprised that you'd have trouble if your other one has like an internal calandry on the 25 that you'd have trouble
the new thing's like a jet engine
kettle.
Well, how about this? So, Garrett, so when you guys expanded Brooklyn Brewery 2 years ago now, right?
Yep.
Was it hard picking the equipment that you would buy?
It was an interesting process. You know, we ended up basically putting together a spreadsheet where we asked different people to bid on exactly the same set of equipment, because what you found was that people were coming back and saying, well, if you want a 50-barrel system, this is basically what we would provide. And you find that people want to show apples and oranges. And what we want is apples to apples so that we can tweak later. So, you know, there was a process that we went through. You know, we ended up with a German manufacturer, largely on the basis that we could get higher efficiency out of that system than we could out of some other people who had bid, And we found that talking to other people who had the same equipment, that it was true, and basically figured out that over a relatively short period of time, we would make up the difference in price in getting, say, an extra 5% out of your malt. And again, that's one of those things that hopefully for somebody at home doesn't matter that much. You know, if you're worrying about getting an extra 3, 4, 5% out of your malt at home, you really have a problem, and you need to consult somebody. You know, you're not having nearly enough fun.
Setting your alarm clock 5 minutes fast so you get up early.
Yeah. I do that. It doesn't work.
I don't know. Yeah,
well, let's jump
I'm
over.
Not
so,
sure I can go
Dave,
all the way with that. I agree with I agree with you, Garrett. That 3% maybe you shouldn't worry about. But when I see homebrewers settling for 70% brewhouse efficiency, I shake my head and I wonder. You know,
you get
to a certain point where you're going to have to, if you're going to accept that kind of efficiency, you have to scale up all your equipment.
So Dave, this is what I think. Your next book should be teaching other pro brewers to brew better. Because I get a feeling you've got a couple more books in you, and you're missing brewing. I know how hard work that is. But I want to turn you guys over to our other friend here, Ken from Crossroads. He's still just starting out. He's got a small brew pub up in Athens. It's 7-barrel system. So why don't you guys turn your expertise to him? So, Ken.
Well, what year were you founded?
Yeah.
What year did you start?
We started 2 years ago we started brewing. We're in our we're coming up on I think it's going to be 3 years in September. Let's see, where are we? November.
It goes fast.
Yeah, it goes. Believe me, it's gone so quick.
How did you decide on the system you have? The 7 barrels to start for a brew pub.
It was actually I bought that system a very long time ago when I got the inkling that I was wanted to get into this business, and I actually had it in storage for quite some time. When we actually got the brewery up and running, we were doing the build out. We found that some of the components wasn't really going to work for us, so we swapped them out, and essentially we ended up with 4 7-barrel fermenters. I have a 14-barrel fermenter, and we have a 10 and a 7-barrel bright tanks that we use. Pretty much, just the opportunity arose for us to purchase that type of system. It was good at the time, and like I said, I held on to it for quite some time before we actually started brewing on it. It's a 7-barrel pub system. So,
you want to tell us something about your coffee porter?
The coffee porter, that would be Hutch Kugman's creation. We use freshly roasted a coffee from a local purveyor. I personally love the flavor of it. I love the aroma's phenomenal. A porter is not my favorite style of beer, but I do enjoy sipping on this one. We also have the IPA, which again, like I said, is our signature beer.
I just spilled some on my hands. It's like I have hops.
And it's Brandon.
Yeah.
So wait, where did you meet to Hutch Klugman? Where did he used to brew before you had him?
Well, Hutch was at Ithaca. He originally started at Pelican Bay out in Oregon. He did when I found him, he was at Ithaca. He did, I believe, 5 to 7 years up at up in Lake Placid. He went from a brew pub setting to a kind of like a shift brewer, and I just found him at the right time. He wanted to get back into the brew pub scene. And he's been with us ever since.
You know, I will say there's a couple other small brewers that I know who did what you did. They bought the system first up in Western Mass. There's Wandering Star, Chris Post.
Yeah, Chris, yeah.
I think he bought his system 3 or 4 years before he ever found a location. And way out in Oakland, there's a dude named Roger Davis. It's called Faction Brewing. He came out about a year and a half ago and bought Captain Lawrence's old system.
Oh, is that right?
And figured out how to drive it out west, and he's still setting that up. So... it's almost like, what is this, like a secondary market for used equipment? Is that what's going on now?
Yeah. Oh, and we're actually in the market right now to upgrade some of our system. We're looking for a 15-barrel bright tank. There is none. I mean, the stuff, whether it's secondary market, brand new, if you're going to buy it brand new, you're going to wait forever. Secondary market, if as quickly as it's posted for sale, it's gone. I mean, what's going on with the industry right now is is phenomenal. The movement that's going on. So it's
and
very,
where
very
you
difficult.
Are you at maximum capacity? I mean, with seven barrels,
we
how
are
many kegs
maximum.
Could you really make in 1 year?
We're going to do 800 barrels this year, and that's about it. I mean, if we can add an additional conditioning tank, we may be able to bump it up to 1,000. But I mean, we're cranking. 2 years into it, when I wrote the business plan, I anticipated our first year to be at 350, second year at 600. We way surpassed that going in.
My question, Kenny, is if you're making 800 barrels a year, where is the stuff that's supposed to be coming to Brooklyn going?
And you're still selling? You're distributing that mostly yourself?
Most of the stuff, yeah, is up in the Hudson Valley.
Oh, so that's what it is.
We have we like to get American begging for the beer. So,
well, I have to say, you know, from a just a purely technical point of view, this IPA is awesome. I mean, it's really really good. I mean, first of all, just I'm looking at it as a brewer, it's super bright. You know, it's got it's got great foam, and it's really nicely balanced. He uses a different set of hops than I would use, but it's his thing, and I'm like, wow, that's really pretty sweet. It's like on the money. It has a certain level of perfection to it. It's really nice.
Yeah. So do you credit your good beer to your brewer, Hutch?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, again, he he's given free rein to do whatever he wants. I think that's the enjoyment for him. Like I said before, he came from a shift brewery setting, he lost a passion for it. Coming with us and working with us, I mean, he's brewing the stuff that he loves to brew, and he's having fun with it. Or at least I think he's having fun with it. He seems to be always smiling.
Where was he before?
Well, he was at Lake. He brewed up in Lake Placid, and he was at Ithaca. But he originally started at Pelican Bay.
And then I'm going to give a shout out to your distributor. One thing that's great in New York is we have a lot of distributors, and Brandon Moore works at American Beer Distributor. It's a family-owned business, and what's great is they're like the incubator for small breweries. You know, Avery, a lot of Shelton Brothers, Captain Lawrence, a lot of small breweries started there, and as they grew, they moved on. And right now, I'm always looking to their portfolio, and it's like they've got Carton in New Jersey and Crossroads from Athens, New York. It's just they're a great resource, for sourcing and distributing these small guys. So, how did you meet Joe in American Distributing?
I actually met Joe quite a few years ago. I was working with another brewery, looking to sign on a distributor, and basically we interviewed the distributors throughout the tri-state area, and at the time, what this particular brewery was looking to do, Joe didn't really feel that he was the guy. Joe's he's an interesting guy as far as what types of beers that he distributes. I think he handles the product the way I want to see it handled. And one of the reasons why I chose, obviously I kept the relationship with him over the years, anticipating that one day I would be able to, get him my own product. I think they do a phenomenal job placing the product where it needs to be. We're not shoving it down anyone's throat. We don't need to be in every single bar. Again, we like the communication. These guys are always here. If there is an issue, I hear about it. So it was a very important decision for us to sign up with a distributor that kind of we work together with and kind of really, really fit for us.
Well, one last thing. We're going to close out soon. But, hey, Dave, again, author of Brew Like a Pro, Dave Miller. Dave, do you have a question for Kenny from Crossroads or Garrett from Brooklyn before we close out?
I have one question for Kenny. Kenny, are you distributing draft only?
Yes. Yes, right now we are, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That sounds like a viable plan. I was thinking, I can't imagine you have a bottling line if you've only got a seven-barrel brew house.
No, no bottling line. Unfortunately, financially, we're not able to get to that level yet.
So, Dave, as a beer lover, so you're saying you love draft beer?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure.
I do, too. I think that's really that's what's driving the craft beer industry, going to a good place, getting a good, clean draft line with really good craft product. Garrett, any comments on draft versus bottle?
Well, actually, you asked me to give you Kenny a piece of advice. I'm going to give Kenny one piece of advice. I'm going to give it to you too because you just did it. Never ever call craft beer product. I always, you know, like some every once in a while, one of my salespeople says that it's like the product. Like, no, the product is like, you know, the Wonder Bread is like the product. You know, our stuff is beer. You know, do not refer to my beer as product.
It makes me think of maybe hair gel.
Yeah, hair gel. Yeah. You know, so it's just, yeah, exactly.
So on Twitter, it's just hashtag craft beer.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah. The word product is banned from our brewery.
Well, this is like a serious schooling for me, and I feel like I have to go back, and I'm going to read through Dave Miller's Brewlecker Pro one more time. I'm definitely going to go back to the 1997 The Good Beer Book by Garrett Oliver and Timothy Harper, which is still one of my favorite books.
Well, what you should be getting, of course, these days is the Oxford Companion to Beer. Once you've gotten Dave Miller's book, the Oxford Companion to Beer from Oxford University Press, which makes, of course, the perfect holiday gift. And in fact, I'm sure that Amazon's probably putting them together anyway, so they have a special package deal, I'm sure, for us.
Are you doing a book signing on that anytime soon?
I have one that'll be coming up with the folks on Orchard Street. I think they're called Top of the Hops.
Top Hops.
Top Hops.
Nice.
Yeah, okay. And that'll be up. I know that we have a date, but I don't remember it off the top of my head. But if you look on their website, I'm sure it's up, and I'll be doing a signing there.
Well, that was also another great book, Garrett, and thank you so much. We'll give a shout-out. Don't forget, New York, people know this, but the rest of the world, there was a big hurricane here, and people are doing relief efforts all around town. December 4th at Brooklyn Brewery, there's a very special event, Drink for Good, that'll benefit many hurricane relief organizations, and you can check that out at brooklynbrewery.com. In Staten Island, which got hit, our friends at Adobe Blues are hosting the annual Brewery Appreciation Day, Sunday, November 25th. You can check them out. Learn more about it at goodbrewsteel.com. And in closing, I'd like to thank our sponsors at greatbrewers.com who have helped to bring this podcast to you tonight. But one more thing. December 1st, it's like Belgian Beer Day in New York. All my favorite beer bars, Spite and Dival, Jimmy's Number 43, and Mugs all have a Belgian-related event. So, again, go to goodbrewsteel.com and you can learn more about it. Actually, some really cool stuff. The Spite and Dival one is Svanza. It's like specialty Cantillon and other Shelton Brothers stuff. Jimmy's Number 43 has Battle of the Belgians, some really cool B United imports, and Muggs has their Split Thy Skull, I think. It's like the serious strong Belgian. So if you're in New York on December 1st, there's three cool places to go to try some of the best beers in the world. And thanks to Garrett, Ken, Brandon, and Dave. Dave Miller, Brew Like a Pro. Thanks for joining me here on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. Thanks to our producers, Jack Inslee and Brie O'Connor, and our engineer, Joe Galarraga. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on Beer Sessions Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.